I don't want to come off and think, well, I could have gone faster and I'm never going to do it again now. If I wanted to do it, I wanted to do it properly.
I watched videos of Mercs being stretched off. I thought it was all a bit of showmanship, and I couldn't walk properly for 4 days.
There's no tactics, no hiding place. It's the ultimate test. You step up and you succeed or fail.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Sir Bradley's Hour Record, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freeb.
Welcome to a special cycling podcast dedicated to Sir Bradley Wiggins' attempt on Sunday, June the 7th, to break the world hour record. This podcast is supported by Jaguar. My name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney. Hello, Lionel.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
This is part one of two, since the cycling podcast team will also be in the London Velodrome on Sunday to bring you coverage of Wiggins' hour record in a live podcast that is also supported by Jaguar. So thanks to Jaguar for making this possible, including that world first, we think, of a live broadcast stroke podcast. Wiggins Hour will also be televised live by Sky Sports, so you can watch the moving pictures there and listen to our alternative commentary, should you wish. Or you can listen to our podcast later, because it will be available after the event. So on with this, part one of our podcast, Our Record Specials. We'll be hearing from the three British riders who have broken the Our Record, Chris Boardman, Graeme O'Bree, and the current holder, Alex Dowsett. We'll also hear from the man behind the Wiggins bike, and in the final part of this podcast, we will speak to the man himself, Bradley Wiggins, just days before he attempts to, in his own words, put the record out of reach. And so, without further ado, let's get on with the show. Let's kick off with Lionel and his semi-regular cycling podcast feature, the Lionel Lecture on the Hour Record. Over to you, Lionel.
As the name suggests, the Hour Record is the record for the cyclist who rides the furthest from a standing start in 1 hour. Our record attempts are made at a velodrome, or cycling stadium, for Daniel's benefit. The discipline dates back to 1893, when Henri Desgranges, who 10 years later would invent the Tour de France, rode 35.325 kilometres in Paris. The record changed hands regularly throughout the first 3 decades of the 20th century, until in November 1942, the event truly captured the imagination, when Fausto Coppi broke Maurice Archambault's record on the Vigorelli track in Milan. Coppi's record stood for almost 14 years until Jacques Anquetil raised it, this time to 46.159 kilometres. In 1968, Ole Ritter of Denmark raised the stakes, heading to Mexico City and high altitude. 4 years later, Eddie Merckx also went to Mexico City to break Ritter's record and set a new one that would stand for another 12 years. And this is when technology really started to play a bigger part in the Hour Record. In January 1984, Italy's Francesco Moser raised the record above 50 kilometres for the first time. He also rode in Mexico City, making 2 attempts in the space of 5 days, leaving the record at 51.151 kilometres. His bike was futuristic, with a sloping top tube, 2 disc wheels with the rear wheel larger than the front one, and upturned handlebars, all designed to be aerodynamic. Years later, of course, Moser admitted he'd also used a transfusion of his own blood to up his red blood cell count. Arguably, the golden age of the Hour Record spanned 3 years from 1993 to 1996. British cycling fans will certainly feel that way, because Chris Boardman announced he was to attempt the record in Bordeaux on July the 23rd, 1993, but it was a Scot, Graeme O'Bree, who beat him to it in Hamar, Norway, a couple of weeks earlier. O'Bree was a true maverick and used a range of unconventional handlebar positions to maximise his effort. Boardman did break O'Bree's record when he had a go a fortnight later, but the Scot reclaimed it in Bordeaux in April 1994. And later that year, the Spaniard Miguel Indurain took the record shortly after winning his 4th Tour de France. Indurain's victory gave the Hour Record cachet again, and in October and then November, the Swiss Grand Tour rider Tony Rominger improved on Indurain's distance. But Chris Boardman set an unbeatable record of 56.375 kilometres on September the 9th, 1996. And it was at this point that the UCI, the world governing body, intervened, arguing that the technology, the shape of the frames, the disc wheels and the extreme handlebar positions was taking too much importance away from that of the athletes. That was until October 2000, when Chris Boardman rolled back the years, riding a standard track bike and spoked wheels, very similar to the bike Merckx rode in 1972, and he set what was known as the Athlete's Hour. Boardman had set out to break Merckx's 72 distance, and he did so in Manchester by just 9 metres. The Czech rider Ondřej Setenko broke Bormann's mark in 2005, but it was not until the UCI relaxed the rules in 2014 and said that a standard pursuit bike with tri-bars and disc wheels would be allowed that the event's popularity was revived. Jens Voigt set a new record of 51.115 kilometres in Switzerland last September, and since then Matthias Brandli and Rowan Dennis have held the record before Alex Dowsett set the existing mark, which is 52.937 kilometres in Manchester last month. Bradley Wiggins, it's over to you.
Okay, so before we come eventually to Bradley Wiggins, we're going to give you a bit more context and background to the hour record. Daniel Freib is a bit of an expert on Eddy Merckx, who is one of the classic sort of figures in our record mythology, I suppose. Fausto Coppi, Eddy Merckx, before there was a resurgence in the 1980s with Francesco Moser, the Italian rider, and then in the 90s with the British riders, Graham O'Brien and Chris Boardman. We'll talk about all of these guys, but start with Daniel and Eddy Merckx. Daniel is the author of The Cannibal, the Eddy Merckx biography, and the hour record for a rider who won 525 races in his professional career, five Tours of France, it's still the hour record that a lot of people talk about in connection with Merckx. It took on a sort of mythology of its own, did it at altitude in Mexico City. And Daniel, for your book, I mean, what did you find out about Merckx and the hour and the famous story that after breaking the hour record he could barely walk?
Yeah, well, I mean, Merckx took on the hour record really because he was running out of other objectives, other races to win. By that stage, he'd won the Tour three times. He'd won the Giro d'Italia four times, I think. And the hour record at that time, as you say, was still considered to be very prestigious, and it was a real void in what was becoming one of the great palmares at that point. So he decided in 1972 that he was going to have a crack at it after the Tour of Lombardy. So he left himself just over 2 weeks after the Tour of Lombardy, so not much specific preparation. Decided he was going to do it at Mexico at 2,285 metres above sea level. And he'd prepared in... He'd sort of rigged up a form of altitude chamber in his garage, or doctors had. And they believed, or they claimed, that it was the equivalent of riding at about 3,600 metres altitude, which sounds fairly implausible, but that is how he prepared, and he went to Mexico.
I mean, Daniel, how did he do that? What was the technology there? Because this was the days before, you know, oxygen tents. Riders now sleep in tents where the oxygen is limited. But how was this constructed?
Featured some kind of mask, and rarefied air was basically being pumped through the mask, I believe. And so Merckx travelled from Brussels to Mexico. I think he spent about 4 days in Mexico before he actually had a go at the record, so not much time to acclimatise at all. The weather wasn't very good, he was very pessimistic. Ernesto Colnago, the famous Italian frame builder, had built his bike. It weighed 5.75 kilos only, which I would suggest is quite considerably lighter than the one that Wiggins will be riding, the one that Alex Dowsett rode. And he was also wearing a very sort of finely crafted silk skin suit. Again, very different from what Wiggins will be wearing. And he was widely expected to break the record. I think his doctor at the time said, you know, 99 times out of 100 he was going to break it, and sure enough he did. The record was previously held by Dane Ole Ritter, and Merckx beat it, and he set a new mark of 49 kilometres 408 metres.
And what about the legend that Merckx had to be sort of helped off his bike and was in more pain than for any of his other feats and couldn't walk for days afterwards? Is this urban myth or is this true?
No, it's true. I mean, Merckx was the kind of guy to... I mean, he was never knowingly sort of undersold when it came to... I wouldn't say exaggerating the suffering that he'd endured in races, but he certainly, yeah, he made it very
fun. A bit of a whinger, Merckx,
yeah,
was he?
A little bit, yeah.
and there it stayed for 12 years, the world hour record, until Francesco Moser in very early 1984, I think it was around about January, February time, in Mexico City. Again, the received wisdom then, I guess, was that altitude was the place to set the hour record. Interesting, I went to Bolivia with Chris Hoy, who was trying to set world kilometer record, and the principles behind going for a record like that altitude were very clear. The air is thinner, there's less wind resistance, and the problems with lack of oxygen in the air for breathing are less of a problem. But with the hour record, that's the crucial factor, surely, the acclimatization.
Yeah, I spoke to Chris Boardman a lot, and we'll hear from him later, but about this kind of trade-off, to what extent the air resistance or the reduced air resistance is offset by the greater difficulty that people have breathing at altitude. And he seemed to think that it was a pretty much an equal trade. There are other people whose opinions differ on that. Just on going back to Merckx, what I did omit was a fantastic quote from Jacques Anquetil. Jacques Anquetil was in the velodrome in Mexico that day.
Jacques Anquetil, of course, Merckx's predecessor as a 5-time Tour de France winner.
Yeah, and also a previous hour record holder. And Merckx climbed off his bike, complained about the pain that he was in, and Anquetil asked him, had he not trained for a full hour? Had he not mimicked the sort of full hour effort before in preparation for the attempt? And Merckx said no, that he hadn't, and Anquetil told him he was a real gherkin.
Well, that's something that Boardman will also address in our interview with him, what kind of specific training you need to do and what kind of efforts you need to do as a rehearsal for the hour record. And we'll hear also from Bardley Wiggins on that topic, of course. So I mentioned Francesco Moser. He took the record past 50 kilometres, 51 kilometres. He rode on a sort of space age looking bike, low profile bike with two disc wheels. And he was trained by Professor Francesco Conconi, who is somebody who would appear later or become better known in cycling in later years. His methods were controversial, to say the least. I think Moser subsequently admitted to blood transfusions for the hour record. It wasn't technically or any other way an illegal practice at the time, and in fact the Americans also did the same at the Olympic Games that same year. It was only later that it was banned, but certainly it puts a little barely visible asterisk against Moser's mark. Nevertheless, that was a mark that stood until 1993, when the unknown Scotsman Graeme O'Bree, and you'd have been following the sport by now, Lionel, you remember no doubt Graeme O'Bree coming along. He had a domestic rivalry with Chris Boardman, who was the Olympic pursuit champion. Boardman had said that the hour record was something he wanted to do. But a week or 2 weeks before Boardman's hour record attempt in Bordeaux, O'Bree sort of staged a last-minute smash and grab in Hamar in Norway. And he had one attempt at the hour record, of course, narrowly missed it on a new bike, decided he would go back to the bike they'd built himself using old washing machine parts with the very unusual sort of tuck position. And 24 hours after failing to beat the record, he did manage to beat Moser's record. He had O'Bree's big fear was stiffening up, was his muscles stiffening up overnight. And so his ingenious solution to that was to he had an internal alarm, which was his bladder, and he drank a lot of water before he went to bed. That got him up with a full bladder an hour or so later. He then, when he got up to go to the toilet, he would drink another few litres of water to get him up in another hour. And every hour that he got up, he did stretching exercises. And he credits that with helping him to break the hour record the next day. Do you remember O'Bree, Lionel?
Well, yeah, I remember this, the rivalry between O'Bree and Boardman at the time, reading through the pages of Cycling Weekly. And it went from being quite an obscure, this battle between two, not much more really, than a club cyclist, Graeme O'Bree, really, when he started out on this journey. Chris Boardman, of course, had won an Olympic gold at the Barcelona Olympics in 92 in the individual pursuit. But, of course, then the track cycling, well, all the cycling in the 92 Olympics was for amateurs. So, Boardman was not the you know, the prologue specialist, the time trial specialist that he later became. He was on the cusp of joining a French pro team, the GAN team. But the hour record, you know, these two Brits, Scott and Chris Borman from the Wirral, sort of targeting this mark that had previously been held by some of the greats of the sport, Coppi, Anquetil, Merckx, and held by Moser. You know, it was quite odd to see this extension of British time trialing, the British time trialing culture, take over the world, really. And I think when Boardman broke the O'Brien's record, because O'Brien beat him to the punch by a couple of weeks, but Boardman broke the record in Bordeaux late July when the Tour de France was arriving in town. And I think Jean-Marie Leblanc, who was the boss of the Tour de France, Christian Prudhomme of his day, took the afternoon off from the Tour to go and congratulate Boardman. And L'Équipe, you know, dedicated as much of their space to Boardman breaking the hour record as they did to the Tour de France. And
Boardman was piggybacking on the Tour, though, which showed the sort of lowly status in a way of the hour record, that it was playing, it was a support act almost. It was like the Tour de France was a headline act and the hour record, and Boardman was a support act.
Yeah, I think if you look at those copies of L'Équipe, and I think Cycling Weekly reproduced the front page and some of the other pages at the time, there was this kind of slight curiosity aspect to it, to look at these crazy Brits having a go at this strange record. But of course, within a year, Miguel Indurain, the reigning Tour de France champion, and then Tony Rominger, who'd been on the podium, won the Vuelta, you know, they gave it that extra credibility and restored it to something that, you know, the real road men, the real road time trial experts could aspire to.
Well, Graham O'Brien always a very colourful character and a great talker. We dispatched friend of the podcast, Susan Egglestaff, former badminton medalist in the Commonwealth Games, Scottish athlete and now journalist. And we dispatched her to go and visit Graham O'Brien at his home in Kilmarnock to ask him a few questions on our behalf. And here's Graham O'Brien talking about what it's like to ride the hour record.
I think that it is a phenomenon which has been inspired by, obviously, the governing body. Starting from scratch, basically, and it's gone through all the gears, is the best way to I would describe it. And it's increment. It's now reaching the point where we're going to see the very pinnacle. I think Wiggins has got so much more background in terms of support, in terms of the machine, in terms of what he has, the ability to actually have resources for the platform to step up than Alex Dowsett has, in terms of the maybe materially and research wise. But at the end of the day, there's a black line and a figure to beat, the number of kilometres in an hour. There's you in the black line, ultimately, in the hour record, and that's a beautiful thing about it. No matter what, that's what it comes down to. There's nothing else in the universe apart from the black line and you.
And how do you think Wiggins will do? What distance do you think he'll get?
Personally think, having Wiggins having done that 10-mile time trial recently at Hull on a course which I also rode in mid-90s, and I know what speed I went at then, and I know how fast Wiggins went, compared to the form I had. Anyway, the bottom line, I've done my calculations, I reckon he's going to do between 54 and a half. Well, I'm guessing 54 and a half to 55 kilometres is my... If I had to put a dart on a board with numbers on it, that's where it would land.
And can you describe just how hard the hour record is?
No. It is... Well, I sometimes describe it as one of those old films with the boiler, the expanding boiler and the needle that goes round in a dial right to the red zone, the big danger thing, danger, and the needle's actually bending the edge of the danger. It's like that for the last 40 minutes. If it's really on the edge, it's not been like that so far because nobody's taken it that somebody has to be in that position. It digs so deep. There's been two or three guys have actually not broken the record, but they didn't seem that bothered about it. Whereas at a very, very, very sharp end, I think that if Dowsett had to step up again and not get it, I think he would have to push your boiler to that level, an emotional level, not just physical, but emotional. That's the point we're getting at in terms of an emotional and physical effort. In other words, the level of our record where your soul has to want it as well.
And is it the hardest single thing you can do as a cyclist?
I believe it is. Eddie Merckx said the same thing. He reckoned it must have taken years off his life. Other riders have said, you know what, that is the most horrendous thing. People who have won the Tour de France. I'm actually struggling to think of something that is... It seems the perfect thing for somebody to turn themselves inside out in terms of physically and emotionally. Like, proactively have to go and drill your own teeth out for the glory of even your emotional survival, for your reputation, for your want of because of how important our record is, as it's a freestanding thing. It's like a man-made Everest. That if you want to be the greatest, an ultimate test of a man, a bicycle, and a black line, under its clinical conditions, there's no tactics, no hiding place. It's the ultimate test of you step up and you succeed or fail.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Download old episodes absolutely free at thecyclingpodcast.com.
So we heard a little bit there from the inimitable Graeme O'Bree. Thank you to Susan Egglestaff for that. Chris Boardman obviously then took up the mantle, as it were, before Indurain and Rominger got in on the act, and then Boardman got back in on the act. And, you know, Boardman had three attempts. We'll hear from Boardman in a moment or two, but he had three attempts at the hour record. He broke it on his usual sort of pursuiting bike initially in 1993. Then he mimicked Graeme O'Bree's later position, the Superman position, with his arms outstretched in front of him, and produced an incredible performance that put the hour record on a very high shelf indeed. 56.375 kilometres, which is still the ultimate record. Boardman then had a third attempt at the hour record on a replica bike of the bike that Eddie Merckx used in 1972, because the UCI had by now decided to curtail the sort of technological development, the arms race that the hour record seemed to be becoming, and take it back to basics. And the idea was that the athlete's hour would be a record restricted to sort of normal or traditional bikes. But Boardman set a new record, beat Merckx's mark from 1972 on a Merckx type bike. And I think, Lionel, you were actually in the Manchester Velodrome when that record was set.
Yeah, I was. That was in October 2000. And it was right at the end of Boardman's career. 2000 was his last season as a pro on the road.
Was that not his last ever race as a professional, in fact?
Yeah, it was. I mean, he deliberately chose to end his career with that hour record, the athlete's hour as it was called, and really he was the driving force behind it. I mean, the UCI changed the rules to effectively make it impossible under the new technology regulations that they put in place. Nobody was going to beat 56.375 without the aid of the Superman position and the disc wheels and everything. So Boardman sort of reclaimed his record, if you like, and he set the terms of reference for it. He said he wanted to beat Eddie Merckx's 1972 mark, which he did by just 9 metres. I mean, I remember being in the Velodrome and having this sense that he was going to do it, because he was confident beforehand that it could be done with the level of condition he was in. I mean, he wasn't at the peak of his powers, far from it. He'd not ridden the Tour de France that summer. I think he'd had he'd been diving and he'd got some kind of ear infection, and he missed the Tour de France in 2000. He then went to the Olympics in Sydney and didn't perform particularly well. He, a couple of weeks before the hour record in Manchester, he rode his final World Time Trial Championships and finished fourth, a minute off the podium. He wasn't flying, that's for sure. But he had embraced his entire cycling career as a sort of scientific experiment, if you like, or a test to see what the human body could do. And he approached this athlete's hour in very much the same way. I always remember the Flesh Will Own in spring of 2000, so a good 6 months really before, 5 months before his hour record, he went off on a very long all-day break with Raimundus Rumsas, and they got a big lead of over 10 minutes going over the Muir de Huy. And you know, it was exciting to watch as a British journalist. It was the first time I'd been to cover that particular race, and at the finish I asked him about, you know, was he dreaming about winning, or, you know, what was he thinking? Was he disappointed that they got caught? You know, had he thought he might win the race? And he very flatly said that winning the race was nothing to do with his day's ride. He was riding with, if it wasn't SRM cranks, it was something very
always
similar.
Put a damper on things, didn't he, Boardman?
Yeah, he did. And he said, you know, he said that was a 7,500 calorie day. And I was like, as a sort of romanticist, if you like, looking at the sort of bike racing as this sort of, you know, the oil painting aspect of bike racing, to have it to reduce to those numbers like that was a really new thing for me. I had never really considered how many calories a rider consumed in a day until that point.
Is another word for romanticist romantic?
A romantic, yeah, that's right, yeah, yeah. But also romanticist.
Let's hear from Chris Boardman, because Boardman, to complete the circle, has been working with Bradley Wiggins a little bit, or certainly advising him a little bit on his hour record attempt. So we'll hear from Boardman about riding the hour and about some of the advice he's been giving Bradley Wiggins.
At the risk of using a well-worn cliche now, we understood the demands of the event. We went out and we made sure we understood it. And I sat down with Brad for half an hour in Mallorca a few weeks ago. And the only thing I could offer, because everything he was doing seemed to be bang on, was make sure you do trials of at least half an hour. That's the only point from which you start to get, you can genuinely project what's going to happen. You need to know what that is. And it's a really scary thing to go out and do a trial like that. It's go and ride, you know, as hard as you can, as hard as you are going to set a world record pace. Go and do it in training for half an hour. It's pretty nasty. And I think the riders who fail are the ones that don't go to the trouble to do things like that. So when I had extreme position, it was only a half an hour, I started to notice we had cramp. And even if we'd done 20-minute trials, I wouldn't have known that until we got to that point in that we had to change the position slightly. So as I'm aware, he's done that. And he will, I have no doubt, he'll understand the demands of the event.
And presumably also what you need is a burning desire to do it, because it's such a hard physical thing to do. Did you feel, sitting down with Brad, that desire to do it is there?
I think he's at the point where he's had enough, isn't he? You know, he's been there for quite a while. And so I see a lot of similarities in that I'd had enough. I'd had enough. At 97, I could see retirement. You know, I signed my last contract, I knew it would be. But that was the point I started to lose interest. But I kept the interest by identifying projects that interested me, that fascinated me. And the hour was one of them, because we understood it well. It was our kind of thing. You work hard, you will get a reward. And it played to my strengths. And I think Bradley's exactly the same. He's at a time when he's winding down and wants to focus. He's focusing on things that keep him interested, which I think is a very smart thing to do.
So what were you able to tell him? I mean, what would be your sort of top tip? Understanding the demands of the event, clearly, but in terms of how you approach it mentally in particular, what sort of insight did you share with him?
Mostly it was go and do a long trials, because that, by doing that, induces other things like pace judgment. You get a feel for what you've got to do, how subtly you have to control the pace. It's like, I think I've used the analogy before, but it's like having a boat with a hole in, and you drive, and the faster you drive, the faster the water comes in, and you can only bail at a certain speed, and you're trying to get it, your bailing to match the rate at which it's coming in. And it's kind of like what it is, because they don't happen instantly. You push harder, you won't feel it for a few seconds, but the water doesn't stop coming in. You know, you don't stop lactic acid build up when you've gone over the top. So if you overcook it, you're screwed. And getting a feel for where that line is, to balance right on the edge of it, you can only get that by doing constant dress rehearsals, just dress rehearsals all the time. So it's second nature. And when you start the event, you know what it feels like. You know, because somebody at the side of the track is giving you information, but they're showing you something that happened a lap or half a lap ago, so it's already happened. So if you overcooked it, you've already done it. So you really, all you want them to do is confirm what you already know. They're just a double check.
And just finally, Chris, I mean, we've heard from various riders over the years, Eddie Merckx said that it was the hardest thing he ever did, that, you know, he was never the same afterwards. As you reflect on your three efforts, and maybe particularly the athletes one, I think, yeah, was perhaps the hardest. Was it, and you rode the Tour de France and all these other races, but was it the hardest thing you could do as a rider?
The most unpleasant thing about it is there's absolutely no chance, when you wake up in the morning, there's absolutely no chance that this isn't going to be a horrifically painful day, because you're going to make it the hardest thing you ever did. The first hour record in Bordeaux with heat was just trying not to pass out. So that had its own challenges. The middle one, with anything, was the least demanding. I just couldn't go any faster, so you're just waiting for the end. And that was peak form, lowest pressure day in Manchester, a record in Manchester. It was perfect. The last one I was hoping was going to feel like the middle one, and it was horrific. And after 10 minutes, I thought, crap, I'm not sure I'm going to do this. And I looked up at the crowd, and there's like 7,000 people there, and I'm going to finish my career in 50 minutes. I've got to keep going. And that was a long hour. And I couldn't walk afterwards, because I watched videos of Merckx being stretchered off. I thought it was all a bit of showmanship. And I couldn't walk properly for 4 days. And I had to sort of semi-stand and have the bike slid away from underneath me. And I don't know what it is about that position, but it just seems to do an awful lot of damage. So, yeah, I don't envy him that.
So since the UCI relaxed the rules again and allowed sort of standard bikes, we've seen several efforts, several attempts at their record. Jens Voigt kicked things off, set a new mark that has then been beaten by several of the riders. A couple of riders have failed, Jack Bobridge and Thomas Dekker, who went retro by going to Mexico. He failed to beat the mark. But the Australian rider Rowan Dennis broke it a couple of months ago now. I met Rowan Dennis a couple of weeks ago, and he spoke about his ride and how he'd ridden it. And he said that his power output for the hour was 410 watts. But he talked about the fluctuations in the power output on a lap of the track, where it would vary considerably between the bends and the straight. And it was quite interesting to talk to him about that. He's going to try and do a Bradley Wiggins now and focus on 3 week stage races for the next few years of his career, but he definitely wants to have another crack at their record towards the end of his career. He says it's certainly on his bucket list of things to do again. But after Dennis, the British rider Alex Dowsett, who had scheduled an attempt in February only to break his collarbone, he had a go at the Manchester Velodrome, and I spoke to him recently on a training camp in Mallorca. He's trying to lose the 3 kilos that he put on for the hour record in order to make selection for the Movistar team for the Tour de France. Now, most people, including, it seems, Bradley Wiggins, as we'll hear in the final part of this podcast, expect Wiggins to beat Dowsett's record. I get the sense that Dowsett might be a little bit irritated by that. I think that's completely understandable. I don't think he had anything like the publicity for his hour record as Wiggins is getting clearly for his, and there's obviously lots of reasons for that. But 52.937 kilometres is the mark that he has set. Rowan Dennis thinks that Wiggins will do 53, somewhere in 53.5 to 54 kilometres. Wiggins himself has suggested 55. Dowsett wouldn't be drawn on how much he thinks Wiggins will do, but he definitely wants to have another go, as we'll hear in a moment. He did say some interesting things about the unique aspect of an hour record, where you walk into a stadium, there are lots of people there, as there were in Manchester for his effort, and it's all for you. You know, it's they're all there for you. And he said that everywhere he looked, he saw banners for Canyon Bikes, for Movistar, Endura clothing. It was all reminders that this was all about him, and that put an awful lot of pressure on. He did say that he thought that Manchester, the Manchester track, was faster than London, which might be a bit of mind games, I don't know, but that was an interesting comment. But Dowsett, I mean, there's a parallel, isn't there, Lionel, with the 90s and the Boardman and Bree rivalry, in that these two British riders are, one of them is a sort of outsider, as Dowsett is, he rides for a Spanish team, whereas one of them is very much the sort of the golden boy of the British system, as Boardman also was.
Well, yeah, and I think that without this kind of rivalry, there wouldn't be quite the same anticipation about Bradley Wiggins' ride. I mean, in order to have any excitement about it, there has to be a meaningful distance to beat, and Dowsett has definitely put a meaningful distance down as a marker. If it was just one man riding around the track for an hour, just to see how far he could go, which is effectively what the hour record is, you know, that's not as compelling as trying to beat a rider who, I think, Richard, as you said earlier when we were talking, you know, Dowsett won that stage of the Giro d'Italia a couple of years ago, beating Bradley Wiggins, who had kind of, you know, gone to the Giro as the kind of sky's golden boy there, and Dowsett put down a fantastic performance in a 60-kilometer time trial. You know, a huge, huge effort. Dowsett holds the fastest time for a 10-mile time trial. Again, that's, you know, where this whole hour record thing keeps harking back to the British tradition of time trialing on the open roads. And so, and Wiggins had a go at a 10-mile time trial recently. The wind was too strong and he was unable to beat Dowsett's time. So yeah, there are all these parallels, and it's being played out in a, you know, very high profile arena. It's in the Olympic Velodrome in London. You know, the world of cycling will be watching, and it's not a gimme. I mean, Wiggins, I think, will break the record, but it's definitely not a gimme. If something goes wrong in the sort of first 15-20 minutes, you know, we might, there's, you know, anything could still happen. You know, we might see an aborted attempt, for example.
Well, let's hear from Alex Dowsett, who, as I said, the line is not terrific because we're speaking to him at his training camp in Mallorca, but he told us again a little bit about what it's like to ride the hour and what it felt like to beat the record.
I'm a real thinker in a time trial. I have as much data on my Garmin in front of me as possible, and I'm looking at it all the time, working stuff out. Obviously, on the track, you're not allowed any of this. During the actual hour, because I was so within myself during it, it was like I could think a lot. So I knew, I was very aware of everything that was happening. I could hear Tony and Joe, the commentators, so I was listening to them. I knew where my sister and my girlfriend were standing, and I was picking other people out inside the track, sort of looking as much as I could without moving my head, and then obviously waiting every 17 seconds to see my split as to where I was, that lap just gone, and then trying to look up at the board to see the timer as well, but I was getting shouted at too because I was lifting my head to look up at it, and I should have stayed tucked in. So and then the lap board as well. So I did. And I think because I knew after sort of 20, 30 minutes that I was going to break the record, I enjoyed it. Like, the hour went very quickly. It was kind of, I guess, euphoric, which made it not very painful at all. I don't remember like any pain from the hour record. I won't be one of these holders that says it will, you know, take years off my life, or it was something I'll never do again. Like, I would do it again in a heartbeat. But I think a lot of that is down to, I think I explained it to my girlfriend, I think, it's like in a time trial, if you're down, then it's, if you're told you're down early on by a long way, then you just kind of, you ride in, you push yourself, but you don't really extend yourself because you know you're not going to win. If you're told you're up by a long way, you push harder, but it becomes easier because it's kind of a euphoria that you know you're just going to destroy everyone and you're in a really good place. And then it's when it's touch and go that you know it's a fight. So I knew quite early on that I was in a very good place. I had a lot in me, and pushing the pedals was easy. Like, the first 20 minutes, I felt like I was just sort of brushing the pedal each pedal stroke. I wasn't actually having to lean on it at all. And then I sort of thought, I started breaking it down. You know, I remember Thomas Dekker said he went through a really bad patch from 30 to 40 minutes. And that was, in the first half an hour, I was breaking it down. I was like, I've done a quarter, I've done a third. Coming up to half distance, there's X amount of laps until I hit half distance. And then I thought, okay, 30 to 40 minutes, Thomas Dekker had a bad patch here. So I got to 40, I was like, okay, I didn't have a bad patch. And then got to, coming up to three quarters, and yeah, just I was just in a good place the whole time.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, Sir Bradley's Hour Record, supported by Jaguar.
Is that where we're going? Is that it over there?
Yes, Daniel, that's the London Velodrome.
The Powered Dome, as they call it. Is that what they call it?
No, it's a velodrome. Oh, right. It's a cycling arena. Right. This one is nicknamed the Pringle. It's a velodrome that was built for the London Olympic Games. Do you see why it's called the Pringle?
Yeah. It's shaped like a Pringle, isn't it?
Yeah, that's why it's called the Pringle, yeah. So we're on our way to the velodrome. It's a few days before Bradley Wiggins goes for the Hour Record. We're going to meet with Bradley Wiggins and a few other people before his final big hit out before the Hour Record on Sunday. I was here yesterday, actually, and he was in very relaxed humour and seemed to be very confident and happy and generally looking forward to Sunday. So we'll head in there now, shall we, Daniel?
Let's do it, Rich. I'm psyched.
Okay, Daniel, we're in the track centre now. We're watching a young rider go around the boards. Victoria Pendleton has just been up there on the boards riding around. I think that's her first time on a track since 2013, the year after her final Olympic Games. In fact, she's just riding towards us now. Yeah. Hello, Victoria. Did you enjoy that?
Yeah.
Soon we're going to talk to Bradley Wiggins, but first we're going to meet John Pittman, the Jaguar engineer who's been working particularly on the aerodynamics of the bike. But you've not been in a velodrome all that much, have you, Daniel? What do you think?
I've been there for quite a few times, 3 or 4. It's very much like the other ones I've seen.
Bigger? This is your first time in the London one?
Yeah, bigger. Looks like a good one. This one.
6,000 seats, hard to believe. I mean, it looks much bigger when there are people in it. When it's empty, weirdly, it looks smaller.
Yep.
Right, listen, let's go and speak to John, the Jaguar engineer, and then speak to Bradley Wiggins.
It started off life as a track version of the Pinarello Bleed, so take off the brakes, take off the gears, all the cables and everything, disc wheel in the front and the back. And then, so that's been our starting point, and then we've iterated from there. And it's basically starts off as a bit of a look-see exercise, because I've not worked on a time trial style bike before, so obviously worked on the F8. I wanted to see what aspects of the learning from that translated over, which ones I needed to recalibrate myself a little bit on. So there's a bit of an initial study. Are we looking at the right things? And part of that study, then you sort of say, okay, plan out your work. Where are the gains to be had? You know, I think, okay, the drag's going up a bit much there, or the way the flow's, way the disc wheel is interacting with the back of the bike and stuff. So obviously the starting point, the Bleed, is really highly optimised for a road time trial with a non-disc wheel in the front and gears, and the handlebars are a bit wider. So you look and say, okay, which aspects, they don't really need changing so much. We're going to look here and here.
So, John, you've been involved in the development of this bike, but until now, it has only existed for you on a screen, essentially. Now you've seen it. What's it like to see the bike sort of in the flesh, as it were?
Parts of the bike look even more extreme than they do on the screen. It's fantastically engineered. It is my general feeling of it. You know, when you probably know yourself, when you pick up a bike that's been... and you can put a bike together out of a fantastic range of components, but if you put it together badly, it feels horrible. This one, all the parts are fantastic, but it's been prepared immaculately as well. Very nicely engineered. All the tolerances feel really nice. They've done a really nice job. I think I could probably do 50 kilometres on it.
So Bradley, a few days away now. We saw you yesterday. You seem very relaxed, very comfortable, very confident. Is it because this feels like your natural habitat, I suppose?
A bit, yeah. And also,
It's the stuff I love doing the most, much like a time trial in a world championship. Or the only difference with this is obviously you haven't got Tony Martin or Cancellaros to go up against, so you can never predict what they're going to do on the day. But in terms of power, which is what it comes down to, I know what I can sustain for 1 hour in these conditions from the weeks of training. So I like that about it. That gives me calm because it's so predictable. Obviously, the conditions will adjust on the day dependent, but I just like that. I've always liked that. If I could have made a career out of doing this, it would have been a lot easier, you know, rather than the sort of uncertainty of something like Paris-Roubaix, where you're trying to draw up so many different scenarios that could happen in the days running up to it. Whereas this, it's, as I say, it's just 1 hour, 16.3 second laps, or whatever, which gives you 420 or 430 watts. Which, so
we're in an empty velodrome now, but on Sunday, obviously, it'll be packed with, you know, it's the hottest ticket in town. All the logos and everything will be for you. Everything will be for you, which is a unique sort of scenario. Have you thought about how that will feel?
No, I don't think I can really. I haven't really thought about that much of it, other than the crowd, really, and how many people will be here, and perhaps how involved they are in it in the early stages. I've seen sort of some of the final clips of Chris's hour record in 96 and 2000 when I was there, and how much the crowd play a part in that last 10 minutes. And particularly recently with Alex's record at the end, when it was quite clear he was coming up on the record. And you try and imagine what that's going to be like in the last 15 minutes. But more the first half, certainly, is controlling that, really, and not going out thinking, right, I'm going to go and match Chris's record. Or it's just keeping real control and discipline, really. So, yeah, I do try and visualise what that's going to be like with the crowd, going through the start, keeping calm, trying to block all that out. And the closest I've probably had an experience, other than pursuiting and team pursuiting, would have been something like the Olympic time trial in London, where it was just wall-to-wall for the whole. There wasn't a point on there where it stopped. And I obviously just focused on my power at that time, which was your reference point. My reference on Sunday will be every 250 metres. Heiko stood on the line with the lap split.
Question that interests me is hydration. It's very unusual to go an hour without drinking, without being able to urinate. How do you manage that? How do you get your body just hydrated enough and not overhydrated?
I've got a nutritionist who's with me here the whole time, and he's kind of managing all that from that point of view. But at the end of the day, it's just drinking purely as much as you can drink, always having a drink in your hand with electrolytes in it. I've trained quite a lot in a heat chamber for this temperature over an hour. I've been in Mallorca, which has been quite hot. So I think being heat acclimatised, being well hydrated, not just the day before, but all week in the run up to it. So every session you do, you're not too depleted from. And that's the best you can do, really. And I think it's how you cope with the heat, really, historically I've coped well with that. So.
Brad, you talk about the heat. I mean, just to put this in context of like maximal efforts that you've done also on the road, for a layman, how does this compare to like the hour of climbing at Mont Ventoux in 2009?
Mentally, I would say it's quite similar. That's the one thing I keep referring to, is I've said it can't be any harder than it was climbing up Ventoux, because that was an effort we approached all day. It was hot that day. It was about an hour long, and it was early stage. It was a case of not going too far up that foot in the forest part, you know, trying to just mark them. And at the end, it was like the last 10-15 minutes hanging on for grim death, coming back to that group, getting dropped, coming back. Although this is a much more constant effort than that one was, and less sort of bluffing, trying to show your opponents you're not hurting as much. I would say mentally that approach to that was as similar as it will get to this. Different circumstances, but certainly it's very similar to that, like I said, the London time trial. That's probably the closest thing in terms of preparation and expectation and that kind of, because there is a lot of expectation with this as well from externally.
I know you know the history of this record inside out, Brad, and in terms of like performance, do you have a view on what the real ranking is? And, you know, is the greatest performance ever, is it Merckx at Mexico, is it Rominger, is it what's your view on that?
I still look at reference with Rominger 94, Rominger 2 55.2. It's what we've been training. That was our benchmark. Whether we achieve that or not, that's another thing. But it was the thing we said 7 weeks ago, right, Rominger 50, that we sort of excluded Chris. It seemed a little bit too beyond what we were trying to do. But his position, his bike was the one that matches most to the current setup. Tube Colnago, you know, tubes, normal helmet. And before that, obviously, you had Boardman on the Corimer, Indrain on the Espada, Aubrey on his bike. So, and before that, then Moser with the big wheels, the little wheels. So Rominger was really the one, I think. I mean, Chris has still historically travelled the fastest in 1 hour on a bike, in a very extreme position that you're not allowed anymore, and on a bike that doesn't resemble the bikes of today. So I would still say that Rominger is the reference point. Merckx, again, completely different bike, completely different setup, but equally just as impressive. I mean, when you look in recent attempts in terms of like Gustav Larsson, 50 kilometres, he only travelled a little bit further than Merckx did on a, you know, 40 years later on modern equipment. Merckx was at altitude, but so I think that Merckx record is still the one everyone, that's the other reference point, is people always refer back to Merckx of 73, because after that then technology took over.
You said yesterday that you've been studying a lot and looking at old YouTube clips. Ole Ritter, have you watched his The Impossible Hour? No, it's not very inspiring, to be honest.
I haven't been before Merckx, really. Right. It's funny.
Is that for motivation or is it to learn?
A bit of everything, really. More how raw, when I watched Rominger's, just how raw it was. Like, I mean, the guy had no track craft whatsoever. His second lap was a 16-second lap, and his third lap was 15.5. Now, 15.5 is like 4-minute 15 pursuit pace. He then came back onto his 16.2, 16.3s, and went through 4 kilometres in 4.25, which would have won him the Worlds that year in the pursuit. And it's just incredible to think that he can continue for an hour at that sort of speed. So just how raw he was. I mean, he fell off the track the first time he got on it when he was attempting that record. And obviously Indrain's, I watch Indrain's because he was my childhood hero. And just amazed at how informal it was back then. You know, they could roll around the track, stop and say, right, I'm going to go now. Rominger would start his Polar watch, and then they just literally went and go. No countdown, no big hurrah. Indrain was the same. The minute he finished and was right, he got sort of swamped by about 50 people, if you watch it on YouTube. Which they actually stopped him from rolling around because he just got mobbed and got forced off his bike. And it the different records that have gone before, how incredible and how different they all are. I mean, Boardman sort of being carried off the bike in 2000, unable to walk. And then more recently, just seeing how, like, the adulation when Alex broke it, you know, it really thought it was like, I've never seen him like that. I look forward to that as well. You know,
that was, and Alex has promised to go for it again. That rivalry between Boardman and Bree obviously captivated people in the 90s. Can you see parallels in you and Alex?
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, I mean, that's what it's for. Like I said, it's sort of man on man, really, and it's that this record is what it's all about. So I hope, I said yesterday, I hope it continues. I hope that, you know, it's been great for the record since Jens decided to go for it, and the influx of people that have gone since then. And I just hope that people continue going for it. Even if they fail, because I think records are there that, you know, that will ratify this. If it's a record on Sunday, that will ratify that more, and give it kudos by people like Cancellara, people like Tony Martin going for it, and if they fail or if they get it. So I think it'd be great for the record.
You've been quite open about, you know, these targets that you're setting yourself, quite ambitious. It seems to be more than just beating the record, where all you have to do is beat the record. Is there an element of, is it almost to put a bit of pressure on yourself, or what's the reason for that?
Well, I just think that I don't want to come off and think, well, I could have gone faster and I'm never going to do it again now. So I think if I wanted to do it, I wanted to do it properly, I could have done it a week after Roubaix, as the record was at that time before Alex went for it and maybe broke it by 500 metres, not a lot of homework, as Indrain did in 94. And have got put that on the list. The love I have for the record, I thought, well, I really want to test myself against the people that have gone before, and I really want to do my homework with it, maybe mix up my position a little bit, change things, and try and get the most out of the record as possible, because I'm never going to do it again. And you know, you want you want it athletically to put it down and hopefully stand for as long as it can stand for. So that was the reason for that, really. So it's going from knowing how far you can push yourself from A to B. And I still, as I said at the start, I still look back at the records of Rominger and Boardman and compare myself with those. I don't look at, well, when we started this project pre-Alex Dowsett's record, I didn't look at it and go, right, it's 52.4, let's train at 52.5, let's get the record. I want to come off here absolutely spent and say, well, you know, Chris has always said about his 96 record that if he ever did it again, the best he could hope to do would be do exactly the same. And I want to come off Sunday thinking, right, there's nothing more I could have done there. So
we'll let you get on, Brad, but you're doing a proper sort of hit out today, the last one. I think you're mimicking Pomferrada, aren't you, that where you did the team
running,
time trial.
Yeah.
And, I mean, for an effort like that, so you're doing a 55-kilometre effort, basically, today. Are you nervous for that?
Not nervous, but focused. You know, I start to really think about what I have to do now, go through that process of that first 5 minutes, you know, not starting too hard, because I think you can afford to do a 25-second first lap and build it. As I said about Rominger, who just went out 110 first kilo. I mean, it's like Merckx did in
106, I think Merckx did, didn't he?
Yeah,
first,
I mean,
kilo.
It's crazy, yeah. Stuff, you know, and I did a start yesterday, went through in 115, which was even still too fast, because there's a long way to go. You know, you've got 59 minutes to go after that first kilo. So it's just running through that, really. And obviously it gets harder and harder and harder. The first 12 minutes are almost free, and it just gets harder and harder and harder after that.
There's a lot being made about the air pressure, and we don't expect you to make the same mistake as Rominger. With the pacing, you know exactly what you're doing. But is there a fear, is there anything that you think could go wrong that is your sort of greatest fear about Sunday?
Yeah, I think it's just it's taking the coaches. I mean, there's a lot of people here from British Cycling that are working on the sort of temperature and pressure and all this sort of stuff, and they'll come up. They obviously, we've got power, which is we can assess the power after each effort and see what. For example, yesterday I was doing 16 threes. And the power was about 450 watts for that power. Now, 2 weeks ago in Manchester, we were doing the same, and it was 408, so it's 40 watts difference there. But the pressure was quite low in Manchester that day. Now, I would never go on that pace if it's that power on Sunday, because it's just too much. So you have to really do our homework in the next few days and assess. It's all about power at the end of the day. So if 16.6s is the power you want to go for, then we say, right, on the day we go 16.6s. You know, it's just as simple as that. I mean, we'll know a lot more after today.
You must be taking it seriously because you've had a haircut.
Yeah, I've gone to my race cut, yeah. So that was another thing. And again, from a heat perspective, you know, it's kind of just feels a lot better when you've got that helmet on and everything. So
the beard stays?
Yeah. Yeah, I've trimmed it down a bit, but aerodynamic does make a lot of difference. So,
yeah. Great, good luck, Brad.
All right.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're almost at the end of this special Our Record preview podcast supported by Jaguar. Stay tuned for our special live podcast on Sunday from the Velodrome, which will also be available to listen to after the event. But to wrap things up, we thought we'd go around the podcast team and get a prediction for what Bradley Wiggins will do. What distance will he do? And, you know, that we're going to be... we're hostages to fortune here. We don't know. We're just sitting in Lionel's living room. But from here, from this vantage point, Lionel, what do you... Okay, Daniel. Okay, Lionel, what do you think Bradley Wiggins will do?
Going first is the poison chalice, isn't it? I think he would do 53.9 kilometres in 1 hour.
In 1 hour, you're predicting 1 hour. That was the obvious. Daniel?
More than Evgeny Berzin when he climbed off after 12 kilometres, I think, in 1997.
That's brilliant. That's as far as you're going to go.
Come on.
Give us a figure.
54.
Point what?
One.
Okay, I'll say 53.8. No, I'll be a bit brave in that. 53.6. 53.6.
What's at stake?
Steak. Steak. Steak dinner. That's steak dinner. Okay, that's we'll leave it there. Thank you very much. And again, we'll be back with you on Sunday for a live podcast from the Olympic Velodrome.
Yeah, keep an eye on Twitter, cycling_podcast, to find out how to listen to our live broadcast on Sunday. You need to visit the website Mixlr, mixlr.com/thecyclingpodcast. But we'll have details on our website as well and our Twitter page.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.